I want to continue in volume 3, taking up at April the 10th, 1900, and the subject is desire. Blessed Jesus continues not to come. O God, what an unspeakable pain his privation is. I tried as much as I could to remain at peace and all abandoned in him, but no, my poor heart could take no more. I did as much as I could to calm it, saying, my heart, let us wait a little longer. Who knows, he might come. Let us use some stratagems to draw him to come. So again, I want to give you Psalm 42 there and Psalm 63. They're the Psalms that explain her pain. So that's Psalm 42 and Psalm 63. So Louisa said, turning to him, I said, Lord, come. It's getting late and you haven't come. This morning I am trying to remain calm as much as I can, and yet you do not let yourself be found. Lord, she said, I offer you the martyrdom of your privation as a proof of love and as a gift to induce you to come. Now, this is perfect, absolutely perfect, that she offers it as a proof of her love and also as a gift to induce him to come. Once she starts offering it in love, she's doing well. It's true that I'm not worthy, but this is not because it's not because I'm worthy that I look for you. Rather, I do it out of love. And because without you, I feel I'm not alive. And since he wasn't coming, I said to him, Lord, either you come or I will tire you out with my speaking, she says. Actually, what she means is my persistence. You have Luke chapter 11, verses 5 to 8, where Jesus tells us to persist in prayer. And if we do that, you'll get what you want. Now, Luke 11 is telling us about the man who arrived in the middle of the night, knocking his neighbour up, looking for bread. And the neighbour said, go away, the children are asleep, I don't want any disturbance. But because the man persists in knocking, it's actually easier to give him the bread than to keep on saying, go away. So the man gets what he wants simply by persistence. So Louisa says that she will persist. You also have that marvellous story in Luke 18, verses 1 to 9, of the woman with the unjust judge. And no matter what he did to her, or no matter what he said to her, she just would not go away. And just for the sake of getting rid of her, he had to give her what she wanted. So this persistence is actually very important. So Louisa said, I will persist until you get tired. And even then you're not coming to me, she said. But who can say all my nonsense, Louisa says. I told him so many things it would be too long if I wanted to say everything. After this, I just barely saw my sweet Jesus moving in my interior. Okay, now again, I remind you of 1 Corinthians 3:16. Know you not that you are the temple of the living God and that the Spirit of God dwells inside of you? And you also have Luke 17:21, the kingdom of God is within. So you look within, but Louisa is always wanting Jesus three-dimensional outside of her as well. So it looked as if he was just barely waking up from sleep. Now, it's like as if Jesus was asleep in the boat. Do you remember the time of the storm and the apostles thought that he just wasn't interested and they woke him up? So that's Mark 4:38. And then he showed himself more clearly, she said, and transporting me outside of myself, he told me, just as the bird flaps its wings when it's about to fly, so does the soul flap the wings of humility at the flights of her desires. And in that flapping, she sends a magnet that draws me, it attracts me in such a way that while she takes wing to come to me, I take wing to come to her. So I want to give you 1 Peter 5:5-9. If you bow before the power of God now, he will raise you up. Alord, Louisa said, it shows that I lack the magnet of humility. If I could spread the magnet of humility everywhere on my path, I would not have to struggle so much in waiting and waiting for your coming. So Jesus didn't get anywhere with that particular illustration with Louisa, but he should get there somewhere with us. That he's telling us that the more we desire him to come, the more he will come. It's not very interesting to come to someone who doesn't want you or desire you. But if somebody really wants you and desires you, it's so much easier to come. So I want to give you Isaiah 40:31. Those who wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like the eagle. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. So, earlier on in this volume, Jesus told us about a passport to enter the kingdom. In April the 16th, 1900, he tells us that there's got to be 3 signatures on the passport to enter the Beatitude on earth. Okay, so he's talking about on earth. So, after I went through most bitter days of privation, Louisa said, and reproaches from blessed Jesus because of my ingratitude and my resistance to his will and to his graces. This morning upon coming, he told me, my daughter, the passport to enter beatitude, which the soul can possess on this earth, must be signed by 3 signatures. And these are, 1, resignation, 2, humility, and 3 is obedience. Resignation, humility, and obedience. Now, resignation first. Jesus said, perfect resignation to my will is wax, which melts our wills and forms a single one between the two. It's sugar and honey. However, at a small resistance to my will, the wax separates, the sugar becomes bitter, and the honey turns to poison. Oh dear. Secondly, it's not sufficient to be resigned, but the soul must be convinced that the greatest good for herself and the best way to glorify me is to always do my will. The whole issue is divine will and love. That's the summary of the 36 volumes. Here is the necessity for the signature of humility, because humility produces knowledge. And Hosea 4:6 tells us that without knowledge, the people perish. Okay, so humility produces knowledge. Produces this knowledge. But who ennobles these 2 virtues? Who fortifies them? Who renders them persevering? Who chains them together in such a way that they cannot separate? Who crowns them? It is the 3rd one, obedience. Ah, yes. Completely destroying one's will and everything which is material, obedience spiritualizes everything and, like a crown, places itself around them. So, resignation and humility without obedience are subject to instability. But with obedience, they will be fixed and stable. Here is the strict necessity of the signature of obedience. So that this passport may circulate in order to pass into the reign of spiritual beatitude, which is the soul can enjoy down here on earth. With these 3 signatures, the passport, without these 3 signatures, the passport will have no value. And the soul will be rejected by the reign of beatitude and will be forced to remain in the reign of restlessness, of fears and of dangers. And to her misfortune, she will have her own self as God. And this self will have the cortege of pride and rebellion. Oh dear. as we go through the volumes higher and higher, Jesus will explain that in the early volumes we have the entering into the divine will and what is important to actually enter into the divine will. As we go higher in the volumes, we have to do to actually remain in the divine will. And then the highest volumes bring the whole thing to perfection. Now, as you watch this progression, because it is a spiritual journey, the divine will, spirituality is not a devotion. It's a journey and it's a mission. And as we go on, it becomes clearer and clearer and clearer that to be one with somebody else, you've got to be like them. I know that sounds obvious. But to be like him, first of all, we have to have the signature of humility to even think about it. But the likeness to him is love. But that's not enough. He is pure spirit. And he has to enable us to move more and more and more towards the spirit. Our thoughts have to be spiritualized, our desires, our motivations, our actions, our intellects, memory, will, heart, and eventually our body. And so the whole thing is a process of being spiritualized and divinized. So what is happening to us here on earth is actually happening to the souls in purgatory, that they are being spiritualized and divinized. Well, I suppose death has enabled the spiritualizing process. So they are being divinized more and more until they're ready for the complete union with God. But this was meant to happen on earth. If we don't do it, the reign of beatitude, of course, is the reign of peace, the reign of union with God, the reign of love. And the opposite of that is the reign of restlessness. I've met so many people who've told me they've no peace of mind. And if they've no peace of mind, they haven't even got the most basic union with God because they haven't dealt with the stuff that's disturbing them. So they're in the reign of restlessness. And if you're in the reign of restlessness, fears are very much prominent in the reign of restlessness. And of course, danger towards sin is very much there as well. And down at that level, you have your own self as your governing leader. In other words, you are your own God. And the more you succeed in being your own God, then you are ruled by pride and rebellion and you become a perfect symbol of the enemy. So the choice that's put before us is either to become a perfect reflection of the Lord or a terrible reflection of the other side. We either enter into light or into darkness. So after this, Louisa said, he carried me outside of myself into a garden, and it seemed to be the garden of the church. There I saw five or six people, priests and others. Now, I usually say laity, but it's also people outside the church, ordinary people in society, who were going astray. And they were uniting themselves to the enemies of the church. Now, that means they're getting involved with modernism and rationalism and Marxism and secularism and humanism and materialism and all the other stuff that's being launched onto the 20th century. And they started a revolution. Now, a revolution is that you go against the will of God and you bring lots of other people into the thing as well. So the other word for that would be apostasy. How pitiful it was to see Blessed Jesus crying over the sad state of these people. Why? Because he paid for their redemption. He loves them. They are his. They are his by right of the fact that he's the creator and that he is the redeemer. Louisa said, "Then I looked in the air and I saw a cloud of water full of large pieces of ice, in other words, a terrible hail, falling upon the earth." Now, the Bible always considered a serious hail storm, when the hail stones are huge. The Bible usually considers that as a very serious chastisement. And towards the end of the 20th century, there were hailstorms in Australia that destroyed cars and houses and killed people. Because it's hail at that size, with that size, is a bit like being bombarded from heaven. "What a disaster they caused upon harvests and upon humanity," Louisa said. So you need your Amos 3:7. The Lord tells his prophets ahead of time. But I hope that he will calm down. And then, more afflicted than ever, Louisa said, "I went back to myself." On April the 20th, 1900, we deal with the cross. So you'll notice the cross, love, entry into beatitude, the mortification to hold us back. Notice the way the whole platform is being described for us to actually pass from our old worldly sinful way of life into this new life. "My adorable Jesus continues to come, but just a little and like a shadow. And even when he comes, he doesn't say anything." That's because he's chastising, you see. "This morning, after he renewed in me the pains of the cross twice, looking at me with tenderness while I was suffering the spasm of the piercing of the nails, and he said to me, 'The cross is a mirror in which the soul admires the divinity.'" Well, that's Philippians 2 from verses 6 to 11. His state was divine, but he did not cling to his equality with God. He was humbler, and he became as men are, but he was humbler yet, even accepting death on a cross. And that's why God exalted him and gave him the name that is above all names. And the name that is above all names is Yahweh, which the Jewish people never pronounce out of respect. "The soul admires the divinity, and by reflecting herself in it, she acquires the features and the likeness that most resembles God." Now, to reflect ourselves in it is 2 Corinthians 3:18, where St. Paul tells us that the more we contemplate God, the more we become like him. "So by reflecting herself in it, she acquires the features and the likeness which most resembles God. The cross must not only be loved and desired, but one must consider it an honour and a glory." Now, most people don't consider the cross an honour and a glory when they have it. Oh, yes, they'll admit that it is for Jesus, but not for themselves. This is to operate like God. Okay. And to become like God by participation, because I alone gloried in the cross and considered suffering an honour. And I loved it so much that in my whole life I did not want to be one moment without the cross. So I want to give you Philippians chapter 3, verses 8 to 16. I want to give you Galatians 6, 14. I want to give you Hebrews 12:2, Colossians 1:20, and Colossians 2:14. So Jesus didn't want to be without the cross. That means paying the price for other people to be set free, or what we call redemptive suffering. So Louisa says, "Who can say what I understood about the cross from this teaching of Jesus? But I feel mute in expressing it in words. Ah, Lord, I pray you to keep me always nailed to the cross, so that having this divine mirror ever before me, I may clean all my stains and embellish myself evermore in your likeness. Now, in these early volumes, Louisa continuously says that when she's in this out-of-the-body experience, that she understands things very well. When she comes back into the body, then the body itself puts a veil on all these matters of the spirit. And it's only as we watch her in these volumes, if we persevere, that we will watch her becoming more and more spiritualized. And the more she does, the more she's able to express it. It's really fascinating what happens. And so you find in these early volumes that the messages she gives us are all short. They're only two or three paragraphs. When you go up into the higher volumes, you can have three or four A4 pages for one message. So Louisa has been liberated to be able to express the divine things on paper. But we won't jump, because we need to take that journey step by step together. So April the 21st, 1900. And again, we're talking about the cross. Have you noticed that when a subject comes up, you very often get a number of messages all on the same theme? As I was in my usual state, Louisa said, or rather a little bit of concern about something which is not necessary to say here, sweet Jesus on coming said to me, "And they are sacred vessels," he said, "and every once in a while it is necessary to dust them off." Now, Louisa is starting in the middle of a sentence. Whatever Jesus said before this, we don't know, because she didn't write it down. The only point at which she began to write is when Jesus said, "And they are sacred vessels. And every once in a while it is necessary to dust them off." Now, he says, "Your bodies are as many sacred vessels." That's 1 Corinthians 3:16 and 2 Corinthians 6:16. "In which I make my dwelling. Therefore, it is necessary that I do some dusting every now and then." That means we need continuous purification. And Jesus said he dusts us when he visits us with some tribulation, so that, he said, "so that I may remain in them with more decorum, therefore be calm." In other words, purification has got to go on continuously, because we cannot imagine the humiliation it is for the Lord to come and dwell in us things of flesh. We just can't imagine it. So I want to give you Philippians 3:18 for that. "Later, after I received communion, having renewed in me the pains of the crucifixion," Jesus added, "my daughter, how precious the cross is. See now, in giving itself to the soul, the sacrament of my body unites her with me. It transforms her to the point that she becomes one with me. But as the species is consumed," which is only 15 minutes, "the union which is truly established ceases." But not with the cross. The cross takes God and unites him with the soul forever. And it places itself more surely as a seal. Therefore, the cross seals God in the soul. Isn't that absolutely amazing? "In such a way that there is never separation between God and the crucified soul." Now, the crucified soul is the one who is completely given to him and continues moment by moment, hour by hour, day by day, continuously giving itself to him, giving itself, giving itself, giving itself, giving itself, sacrificing itself for love, sacrificing itself for love all the time. So divine will and love is the essence of what God has asked us to enter into. So April the 23rd, 1900, he comes back to talk about resignation. And he says it's like oil that is a salve for the body. So finding this morning, finding myself outside of myself, I saw my sweet Jesus suffering very much. And I prayed him to share his pains with me, and he said, you too suffer. Rather, I will take your place and you will do for me the office of a nurse. Now, in volume two, he asked her to be a second mother for him on the earth, so that he often comes to her as an infant and asks her to do ministry to him. And that simply is an illustration of, or shall I say, an explanation as to what her ministry is in intercession and as a victim soul. So now she's asked to be a nurse. So it seemed that Jesus placed himself in my bed and I beside him began to check his head, removing the thorns that were driven into it one by one. Then I moved on to his body and visited all his wounds. I dried up his blood. I kissed them, and I had, but I had nothing with me to salve them so as to mitigate the spasm. Then I saw that oil was coming out from me. I took it and I salved the wounds of Jesus, but with some concern, as I didn't understand what the meaning was of this oil coming out of me. We'll talk about the oil first. But blessed Jesus made me understand that resignation to the divine will is the oil, which, while salving and mitigating our pains, salves and mitigates the spasms of the wounds of Jesus at the same time. Because resignation calms and heals us from the agitation that we had beforehand. Then, after performing this office of my dear Jesus for quite some time, he disappeared and I came back to myself. Now, you may wonder what on earth she's doing to the body of Christ. But if you go into the Hours of the Passion, you have in the agony in the garden, you have after the creation of the Eucharist, and you have her on the cross, and she goes through all the wounds of Jesus, making reparation, making reparation, making reparation. And she loves him for everyone in the divine will. She kisses him for everybody in the divine will, and she offers reparation for all the wounds from head to toe. So that's what you're getting here in picture form. April the 24th, 1900, the Eucharist and suffering. This morning, having received communion, Louisa said, it seemed to me that the confessor was placing the intention of making me suffer the crucifixion. And at that very instant, I saw my guardian angel who laid me on the cross to make me suffer. Now, most of us don't think that the guardian angel will do that particular function. But if you go to the prophet Daniel in the Old Testament, the prophet Ezekiel in the Old Testament, and the book of Revelation in the New Testament, just to give you three examples, you will find that it is the angels who always carry out God's will upon the earth. Louise's guardian angel laid her on the cross and made her suffer. After this, she said, I saw my sweet Jesus, who sympathized with me and told me, I am your refreshment and my refreshment is your suffering for souls. Now, that suffering for souls, of course, is the reparation that the victim soul does, and does it out of love. So notice that this is reciprocal love from Jesus to the soul and vice versa. And he showed an unspeakable contentment for my suffering, and for the confessor, who by means of the obedience to suffer which he had given me, had procured this relief for him. Then he added, since the sacrament of the Eucharist is the fruit of the cross, I feel more disposed to concede suffering to you after you receive my body. So you will have noticed from the very beginning that it's after Louisa has received Holy Communion that these communications about suffering take place. In fact, in seeing you suffer, it seems to me, Jesus said, that I continue my passion on the earth for the good of souls, not mystically, in other words, not in some airy, fairy place, but really, it's actually happening. And this is a great relief for me because I collect the true fruit of the cross and of the Eucharist. So here you have Louisa representing the body of Christ, going through the passion of Christ on the earth. And she can only do it bit by bit because, after all, she's only a little creature. Jesus was able to take it all at the same time. After this, Jesus said, "Up until now, it was obedience that made you suffer. Do you want me to enjoy myself a little bit by renewing again in you the crucifixion with my own hands? In other words, would you actually let me do it?" And Louisa said, "Though I felt great suffering and still fresh the pains of the cross, which had been renewed in me," she said, "I said, 'Lord, I'm in your hands. Do with me whatever you want.'" So that's like the fiat of Blessed Mother in Luke 1:38. "Be it done unto me according to your word." So, all content, Jesus again began to drive the nails into my hands and feet. I felt such intensity of pain that I myself do not know how I remained alive. But I was content because I was making Jesus content. Then, after he bent the nails, placing himself near me, he said, "How beautiful you are. But how much more does your beauty grow in suffering?" In other words, he's talking about interior beauty. "Oh, how dear you are to me. My eyes are wounded in looking at you because they see my very image in you." That's Romans 8:29. And he said many other things which would be useless to repeat. "First, because I'm bad," she said. "And second, because not seeing myself as the Lord tells me, I feel confusion and blushing in saying these things, but I hope that the Lord will make me truly good and beautiful. And then as my blushing would fade, I will be able to distribute them." So I stop here. I want to give you Galatians 2:19. Now, there's a mystery here. Louisa is suffering the passion and she's allowed to suffer it just for a short time. And that's because of the weakness of human flesh. Otherwise, it would kill her. And then Jesus comes along and he says, "Would you like me to enjoy myself by giving you the crucifixion myself?" Now, we really need to think about this. Because when we think of the crucifixion of Christ, we have this image of the baddies in Israel hating Jesus and causing him all kinds of terrifying pains. And we have that baddie Pilate who is condemning him unjustly and blah, blah, blah. And we don't realise that none of that could have happened if Jesus hadn't willed it. And if Jesus hadn't actually surrendered his divine power. And if Jesus hadn't surrendered to them. And that he wanted this suffering in order to be able to show us the utter limits of love. In order to be able to show us that as far as God is concerned, God would do anything to save us. He would do anything to let us know that he considered us very precious. And to let us know that God is completely different to what we think. That God himself wanted to pay this infinite debt. It's just amazing. You know the parable about the unforgiving debtor. Now, that unforgiving debtor represents every sinner that ever lived. And when we commit a sin, we're sinning against an infinite being. Therefore, the debt is infinite. And therefore, just as you're told in the parable that no matter what the man did or suffered, he could never, ever pay the debt. So the only chance he had of anything was to throw himself at the mercy of a king who was going to condemn him. And the moment he throws himself at the mercy of the king, he gets instant and absolute forgiveness. Now, you would expect this person to suffer from some kind of psychological shock. One minute I'm being sold in slavery, myself, my wife and my children, to try and pay a debt that I can't pay. And all of a sudden, I'm free. And so you're completely and totally shocked when the man doesn't even say, gee, thanks. There's no gratitude in him. There's no humility in him. There's no love in him. And he shows this by maltreating one of his fellow servants. So the unforgiving debtor is us. Because throughout these writings, Jesus identifies the human race as the ungrateful one. The one who does not appreciate what was done for them. Does not say thank you. Does not take the gift and let it do the work that it can do in us. And so it's a terrible picture of us. And so when Jesus says to Louisa, can I actually get you to participate in this mystery from me? He's talking about the fact that Louisa explains in the agony in the garden, in the hours of the passion, that Jesus suffered a passion of love given to him directly by the Father, the passion of sin given by us, and then the what she calls the passion of the Jews, in other words, what human beings did to him in the crucifixion. But the worst passion was the passion of love. The second worst one was the passion of sin that made him sweat blood. Okay, so Jesus is asking Louisa to participate in this extraordinary mystery, that she would allow the passion of love to happen. And therefore she would be very, very, very much in the image of Jesus. That's what's causing him joy, that somebody else is willing to give this sign to the Father, that they love God beyond reason and they love their neighbour beyond reason as well. So it's a wonderful thing that's happening there. That's why he tells her how beautiful you are and your beauty grows in suffering. It's because of this unbelievable love that's behind it. Okay, so let's go on to April the 25th, 1900, where we talk about purity of intention. Now, this is one of the vital lessons in volumes 1 to 4, that we are told that we must have purity of intention. That means you have only one reason for doing something, and the only intention that's accepted in the divine will spirituality is that you do everything for love of Jesus. Let me give you an example of an intention that's not pure. Pure means unmixed with something else. Okay. Virgin means untouched by something else. So let me give you an example of impurity of intention. So I tell my friends and my family that I'm going to fast for a few days, you know. And everybody says, oh, isn't she so religious? You know, isn't it fantastic? You know, she's doing this incredible thing that we couldn't do and blah, blah, blah. But in the back of my head, I'm saying to myself, but I could lose a few pounds as well. Now, it's that thought in the back of my head that makes the whole thing impure and makes the fasting of no value whatsoever. There's poison in the intention. I get that clearly and you'll understand why Jesus comes back time after time to tell us that we must have purity of intention, that we do something for one reason only, and that one reason is to love Jesus. If you want to see this very clearly, you'll see it in the writings of Saint Therese of Lisieux, where she continuously says she's doing everything for love of Jesus, for Jesus alone, for love of Jesus. No matter what it is, she's doing it for love of him. You repent for love of him. You serve your neighbour for love of him. You deny yourself for love of him. You pray for love of him. You do everything for him. So this is April the 25th, 1900. As I was in my usual state and not finding my sweet Jesus, I had to go around very much to go in search of him. Finally, I found him in the arms of our Queen Mother, suckling milk from her breasts. As much as I said and did, he did not seem to pay attention to me. What child would pay attention to you when they are receiving life from their mothers? Who can say the pain of my poor heart in seeing Jesus and not paying attention to me? Then, after I gave vent to my tears, having compassion on me, he came into my arms and poured from his mouth a little bit of that milk which he had suckled from his mother. Now, look at the cycle of life that's going on here. The milk went from her to him and from him to Louisa. Now, milk represents life for an infant. So this is divine life being passed on. After this, she said, I looked into his breast and he had a little pearl, so refulgent as to invest his holy humanity with light. Wanting to know the meaning of this pearl, I asked Jesus what it was, which, while it seemed so small, was spreading an awful lot of light. And Jesus said, this pearl is the purity of your suffering, which, though small, because we're only one little human being, it is the cause of so much light, because you suffer only for love of me. There's the purity of intention. And you would be ready to suffer more if I conceded it to you. My daughter, purity in operating or working, whatever you're doing, is so great that one who works with the sole purpose of pleasing me alone does nothing other than spread light from everything they do. Now, you need to take that little statement out of the book, write it on the back of an old envelope, read it, read it, read it, read it, read it, until it gets into you. And I want to give you John 8:29. For this, I only do what pleases him, Jesus said. He only operated to please the Father when he was on the earth. So let me just read that for you again. My daughter, purity in working, that is in all your works, is so great that one who operates with the sole purpose of pleasing me alone does nothing other than spread light from all that he does. One who does not operate in this upright way, you see, if it's not upright, it'll be impure motivation, which I've illustrated for you, even in good, does nothing other than spread darkness. So that's John 3:19-21. Then I looked into the heart, the breast of Jesus, and he had a most clear mirror. And it seemed that those who walked in an upright way, that is with purity of intention, remained completely absorbed in that mirror, while those who did not remained outside, without being able to receive any imprint of the image of blessed Jesus. Now, you really need to look at that, that if we're doing stuff for ourselves or with mixed motivation, you don't receive any imprint of the image of blessed Jesus. That's frightening. Ah, Lord, she said, keep me all absorbed in this divine mirror that I may have no other shade of intention, of course, except in loving you. So May the 1st, 1900, we come back to the Eucharist and the cross again. After I received communion, my sweet Jesus made himself seen all friendly. And as it seemed that the confessor was placing the intention of the crucifixion, my nature felt almost a repugnance to submit itself. Now, I find that very comforting, that while Louisa was always willing to suffer, there were times when, you know, human nature didn't really want to be that sacrificial. And it just tells us how human and real she was. My sweet Jesus, to cheer me, told me, my daughter, if the Eucharist is the deposit of future glory, that is John 6:54, the cross is the disbursement with which to purchase it. So the Eucharist is the deposit of future glory, but you will get it through the cross. He says the payment. If the Eucharist is the seed that prevents corruption, like those aromatic herbs that prevent decomposition when applied to corpses, And the Eucharist gives immortality to the soul and eventually to the body. The cross embellishes and is so powerful that if debts of sin have been contracted, it becomes their guarantor. And it more surely obtains the restitution of the debts deed. Now, this is given to us in official language. The Church has always taught us that if we receive communion worthily, that the stains of involuntary sin and defects will be cleansed in our souls. And after the Eucharist has satisfied every debt, it forms the soul in the soul. After the Eucharist has satisfied every debt, it forms for the soul the most refulgent throne for your future glory. That's all in John 6, that you'll have everlasting life. Ah, yes, the cross and the Eucharist alternate naturally, and one operates more powerfully than the other. You need both. And God loves us so much that he makes sure that we have both, not just one of them. And then he added, the cross is my flowery bed. That's an amazing image. Not because I did not suffer harrowing spasms, but because by means of the cross, I delivered many souls to grace. And I could see many beautiful flowers bloom, which would produce many celestial fruits. So for that, I want to give you Galatians 6:14 and Hebrews 12, verses 1 to 4. I also want to give you Revelation 5 from verses 6 to 10. Okay, so what Jesus is saying here, I'll give it to you from Hebrews, that Hebrews reference that I've just given to you. Hebrews 12:2 says that for the joy that was set before him, Jesus endured the cross, despising the shame. In other words, he was looking for the celestial fruits of the sacrifice. So let's look at this again. The cross is my flowery bed. In other words, the place where he's going to have a rich harvest. Not because I didn't suffer harrowing spasms, but because by means of the cross, I delivered many souls to grace. And I could see many beautiful flowers bloom. So these are the special flowers in the kingdom of God. We call them saints, which would produce many celestial fruits. So in seeing so much good, I held that bed of suffering as my delight. And I delighted in the cross and in suffering. You too, my daughter, take pains as delights and delight in being crucified on my cross. And that is because Louisa is aware of the fact that every single time she takes any aspect of the crucifixion, that there's going to be an incredible harvest. And so he says, I do not want you to fear suffering. Almost wanting to act like a sluggard, meaning someone who doesn't put up with it really. Up, he said, courage, be brave, and on your own expose yourself to suffering. Now, what is he saying? Up to now, Louisa was saying, oh, if obedience says it, I'll go along with it. If obedience says it. So Jesus is saying to her, why don't you participate now? And you yourself can ask for the cross. As he was saying this, I saw my good guardian angel ready to crucify me, she said. I stretched out my arms on my own, which is exactly what Jesus was saying. You yourself participate more. In other words, he's saying to her, he has been saying to her since volume one, you must be an exact image of me. But Jesus chose the cross as a means of redemption, and he chose all the dreadful sufferings that he had, not because he enjoyed the sufferings, but because it was going to have such an immense fruit. So he's saying to her that she could step forward as well in the same way, and she did. She's very good. I stretched out my arms on my own, she said, and the angel crucified me. Oh, how good Jesus delighted in my suffering, simply because she has stepped forward much better in her role of another Christ. And how content I was, she said, that such a miserable soul could give pleasure to Jesus. It seemed a great honour for me to suffer for love of him. So on May the 3rd, 1900, we have something that we wouldn't know about unless Louisa actually told us, that there is a feast of the cross in heaven. Now, she doesn't tell us when it is. We know that August the 15th is the feast of the divine will in heaven. That's what Jesus said to Louisa, but she doesn't actually give us a date. So the feast of the cross. Now, first of all, I want to give you a whole lot of references because I want to read the text continuously. I want to give you 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 3 to 11. I want to give you Romans 8, 18, Matthew 16, 24, Luke 14, 27, 1 Peter 4, 13, and Colossians 2, 24. Now you're going to have to look them up. That's your exercise. This morning I find myself outside of myself, Louisa said, and I saw all of heaven studded with crosses, some small, some large, some medium. Some which were larger emanated more splendour. It was a most sweet enchantment to see so many crosses adorning the firmament, more refulgent than suns. Then it seemed that heaven opened, and one could see and hear the feast that the blessed were making for the cross in heaven. Those who had suffered more were celebrated more in heaven on this particular day. One could distinguish in a special way the martyrs and those who had suffered for God in a hidden way. Oh, how esteemed were the cross and those who suffered more in this blessed dwelling. Now, everybody gets a little bit of the cross. Jesus tells us that himself, that he placed every single one of us in the cross when he picked it up to carry it to Calvary. But the people who suffer in a hidden way is mostly a reference to the victim souls who are prepared to suffer incredibly, not because they have to suffer, but because they offer themselves to be the person who stands in the breach between divine justice and the sinfulness of the human race. And so they are the martyrs of love. And Jesus always calls them the loving souls, the ones that he has special predilection for. Now, there are lots of other people who suffer in a hidden way because of their humility. These are probably not aware of themselves being victim souls in any way, and they may be. And because of their humility and their shyness, if I can put it that way, the Lord lets them suffer. And even maybe the people in their own household doesn't realise that they have saints on their hands. As I was seeing this, a voice resounded throughout the whole of heaven saying, "If the Lord did not send crosses upon the earth, he would be like a father who has no love for his children, who wants to see them poor and dishonoured instead of honoured and rich." Now, since volume one, we've been told so much about the cross that I don't need to go into it there. The cross is the instrument for purification, salvation and glorification for us if we enter into it. The rest that I saw during this feast, Louisa said, I've no words to describe it. So she leaves it there. So May the 9th, 1900. Louisa sees the mystery of the Most Holy Trinity in the form of three suns. You see, we're back to this image of the sun again, because the sun is the source of light. And it's when I read these readings about the sun being the source of light and that Jesus can speak so much through it, it makes me have compassion for the old pharaohs in Egypt who worshipped the sun as a god. They called it Ra, and the Pharaoh of the Exodus was called Ra-Mises. That means the son of the sun god. Now, they worshipped the sun because it was the source of light and heat, and that it fertilized everything on the earth, and that life on the earth wasn't possible. The reason why I have compassion for them is that they were not completely wrong. That if they could only have moved a step further and realized that there was a person behind the sun, it would have been a most wonderful stage for the human race. It's a bit like an infant at its mother's breast. It's only a few days or a few weeks old and it's sucking away, and it looks up and discovers the first major discovery of its life, that there's a person behind the food. And it's a very wonderful moment for both the mother and the child when the little hand comes up to touch the mother's face. There's a person behind the food. And then the mother's hand goes down to the child's face. Yes, it's a person who loves you. It's not a thing. It's most wonderful. And it helps me to intercede for the pharaohs. So Louisa said, this is May the 9th, 1900. After I'd gone through days not only of privation, but also of disturbance. Now, she's not supposed to be disturbed because the Lord wants us to be in complete calm. This morning, as I was yet more disturbed about my miserable state, adorable Jesus on coming said to me, by being restless, you have disturbed my sweet rest. So I want to give you Psalm 132, verse 8, that the Lord rests in the soul who is at peace. Ah, yes, he said, you do not let me rest anymore. In Matthew 11, 28-30, Jesus invited us to come and rest in him. Okay. And in Hebrews 4, from verse 3 up to about verse 5 or 6, we can enter into his rest. But it should be a mutual rest, because if there is peace in me and he is the King of peace, if there is love in me and he is the King of love, then it's mutual rest. Okay. So that's Psalm 62 as well. My soul, rest in God. And the psalm says it over and over again. So Jesus is saying to her, by being restless, you have disturbed my rest. And you won't even let me rest anymore. Who can say how mortified I was, Louisa said, on hearing this, that I had deprived Jesus of his rest. In spite of this, I calmed down only for a few hours, and then I found myself more restless than before. Because if you are disturbed interiorly, you don't overcome it easily. It's like the waves of the sea. It keeps coming in, coming back. It takes quite a bit to overcome it completely. So after those few words spoken by Jesus, I found myself outside of myself, and looking into the vault of the heavens, I saw three suns, capital S. One seemed to set in the east, one in the west, and the third in the south. The splendor of the rays that they sent forth was so great that they united with one another in such a way as to become one. Now, I don't know the significance of one of the suns representing one of the persons of the Blessed Trinity setting in the east and then the west and then the south, but I'm going to make a suggestion. And you have to understand that ladies are not allowed to be infallible, so I could be completely wrong. If you study the Bible, God the Father made his rest in the chosen people and there in the Middle East. And so all the Bible is about the Middle East. Jesus, God the Son, made his rest in the church, and the church moved completely into the West. Now, if this is telling us that the Holy Spirit is going to find his rest in the south of the world, that's very interesting. I could be wrong. I've said it before. Louisa says, the splendor of the rays that they sent forth was so great that they united with one another in such a way as to become one. I seemed to see the mystery of the Most Holy Trinity here, and man formed with the three powers in its image. Now, the three powers are the intellect, memory, and will. I also understood that for one who stayed in the light, his will would be transformed by the Father. His intellect would be transformed by the Son. and his memory would be transformed by the Holy Spirit. How many things I understood, but I am unable to manifest them. We have to wait for the higher volumes for Louisa to begin really writing what she sees. So I'll give you one more. May the 13th, 1900. This was the weight of the privation of Jesus. I continued in the same state and maybe even worse, Louisa said, though I do as much as I can to remain peaceful without getting disturbed because obedience is demanding it. But in spite of this, I do not cease to feel the weight of the abandonment that presses upon me and reaches the point of crushing me. And that's the weight of the privation of Jesus. Now, for this, I want to give you Psalm 22, verse 1. My God, why have you forsaken me? And also I want to give you Sirach chapter 2. My son, if you desire to serve the Lord, prepare yourself for an ordeal, because gold is tested in the fire and chosen men, people, are tested in the furnace of humiliation. Also want to give you Wisdom 9:15, which you can look up yourself. And Louisa says, what a state this is. Tell me at least, where have I offended you? Now she persists in that, and Jesus persists in telling her it's nothing to do with any offence. What is the cause of your abandonment? O Lord, if you want to continue this way, I think I will not be able to endure anymore. Then he made himself seen for just a little, and placing a hand under my chin to encourage her and to raise her up. You know, the old definition for prayer was the raising of the mind and the heart to God. And so Jesus is tipping the chin up to try and get her to think. And he said, my poor daughter, how you have reduced yourself. And sharing his pains with me, he disappeared like lightning, leaving me more afflicted than before. Now, all he did was make that very simple gesture of raising her chin, as if he had not come. Or rather, I feel as if he had not come for such a long time, and I feel such afflicted that though I live, my living is a continuous agonizing. In other words, she's teetering between life and death is the way she feels. And it's best expressed in Psalm 42 and Psalm 63. Ah, Lord, she said, lend me help and do not leave me in this abandonment, though I deserve it. Okay, so she realizes that humility is the safe place to be. So I'm going to leave it there for a while.